This week, the Dow Jones Industrials recovered sharply, roaring back to life with a gain of nearly 600 points. Hello and welcome, everyone. Great to be back with you this weekend. Your host, Chris Waltzek. We have another two must-hear guest interviews lined up. For much of North America, this has been an unseasonably warm autumn season, but the Chicago area was just hit with an Arctic blast, which dropped 16 inches of snow on the Windy City. Could the markets be facing an unexpected cold front, with the first rate hike now a near certainty in just 3 weeks? Joining me with their perspectives on the market, first up, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and former columnist for the Wall Street Journal and Business Week, says this would have never happened during his tenure in Washington, D.C. Things have changed so much, a collapse of the national house of cards, as he puts it, is imminent. It's no longer a question of if, just merely a matter of time. Each one of our top money center banks now owes, then, everything produced by every person in business in the entire globe for a year. Amazing. $76 trillion on annual GDP. That's just a drop in the bucket for some of these big banks in the U.S. Well, this is keeping him up at night. He says the system is doomed to failure and the debt could create a deflationary sinkhole. But once the gold market rigging, as he calls it, is revealed, eventually the yellow metal, much higher. Music to all of our ears. And then Eric Fier, President, CEO, and Director of Silvercrest Metals, joins the show. As a geological engineer and certified geologist, he knows the mining business from the ground up. Silvercrest Metals is a reset of the successful Silvercrest Mines with the same red-hot management team. They're using an exciting new strategy to maximize shareholder wealth, the phased approach, they call it, and it's really just economical and pragmatic. You start operations on a small fashion, and you only expand from the money or the cash flow that you receive from that specific project. That keeps costs in check, protecting share value. And then Robert Ian returns to the show with his latest must-hear report. And we'd like for you to call into our toll-free hotline if you'd like. Each month, we'll try to get to your questions and comments, and they accumulate, so you have time to call in 1-206-6665-370. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Heavy weather hovered over the New York COMEX exchange for the second week running on dollar strength amid hawkish Fed governor comments. Gold really finished, though, near the break-even point, off only about $6, finishing at $1,076. Silver just gave back 8 cents, about 0.5%, finishing at $14.15. And then the XEU Gold and Silver Index fell less than a point, down 1.5% at $44.77. West Texas Intermediate Crude actually gained about 73 cents. 1.5%, $41.50 per barrel. The top story moving the markets continues to center around central bank rate positioning. That's right, more hike speculation by the Fed and the EU. The current Fed Funds Futures contract indicates about a 73% odds of a rate hike at the upcoming FOMC meeting, slated for about 3 weeks, December 15th and 16th. According to the Fed Vice Chair Stanley Fischer, policymakers have given the markets ample warning of their intentions to rate hikes. It really looks like they're finally going to pull the trigger. Talk about the Grinch who stole Christmas. In addition, Atlanta Fed President Dennis Lockhart noted his preference to raise rates soon, with further increases at a measured pace. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, gold stocks continue to hold up this week. A few profits taken off the board. Tickers like NEM, Newmont Mines continues to hold up. I expect more solid buying opportunities to unfold in coming weeks and months. And we're also getting reports from Switzerland, the world's number one gold refining center. It was the best month out of 7 for sales to China. You know, that red-hot demand from Hong Kong continues. My forecast remains the same here. I expect rate hikes to continue to lead to dollar strength, making the yellow metal a bargain in the U.S. for the long-term investors over the next year. I think policymakers will move rates higher, about 100 basis points or so, 2016 or next year. It's also possible the markets have factored in the upcoming rate hikes. Moving on to Wall Street, mostly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors cheered hawkish comments from the Fed as reason to suspect policymakers see signs the domestic economic conditions are a little more robust than expected. The Dow held above that 17,000 point now for the eighth week running, ending at 17,823, up 578, 3.5%, while the S&P 500 ended at 2089, up 66, 3.25%, and the NASDAQ added 177 points, the biggest percentage gainer on the week at 3.6%, finishing at 5106. In related news, Fed colleagues at the EU noted on Friday that steps would be taken to increase the zero rate of inflation across the region. Clearly, officials in Europe are more concerned by slow economic output and unemployment. They continued to promote monetary stimulus programs. The net impact of their expansion plans and Fed hawkishness sent the U.S. dollar back within earshot of multi-year highs. Although the dollar strength hurts domestic exporters' profit margins, it does attract capital to the U.S., bottom line on Wall Street. R7 component sentiment index fell back into the neutral zone in recent weeks, and although the market has made a solid recovery, the threat of higher rates, I think, will eventually impact the corporate appetite for stock buybacks, as much of their funding has involved the issuance of corporate debt. So as rates climb, CEOs will likely find it increasingly expensive to finance the purchase of their own shares or their treasury stock. The increase in buybacks was a major underpinning of the remarkable stock market advance of the last 5 or 6 years. So for the time being, I'm neutral on market direction and negative on valuations, given the excessive CAPE ratio. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with CEO Eric Fier and Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Pleasure to welcome back Dr. Paul Craig Roberts to the show, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury of Economic Policy during the Reagan administration and a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week. Welcome back, Dr. Roberts.
Thank you.
You've gone on record with some very startling and interesting and not to mention successful forecasts. There are some ominous signs that you see on the horizon, particularly for the United States and for our financial system. Curious as to whether or not you still feel that this house of cards, as you've called it in the past, might collapse in the coming years.
Oh, it'll definitely collapse. There's no doubt about that. But knowing exactly when is something that's the hard part.
Timing can be challenging.
It always is. That's correct. The system is so heavily rigged, I wouldn't have thought it possible. And of course, in the years I was in the Treasury, nothing like this could have happened just because the ethics of pulling government would have prevented it. But there's no longer any integrity in the United States government or in any aspect of it. We've got the policy of the country controlled in the interest of a few mega banks that have a balance sheet that's seriously in trouble. Banks that have derivative exposure, individual banks with derivative exposure equal to world GDP, a combination of 3 or 4 banks with derivative exposure equal to many multiples of world GDP, a policy in which the banks who control the Fed and provide the secretaries of the Treasury and whose executives staff the financial regulatory agencies, they run the policy to keep the banks afloat. And the consequence, of course, for everybody else is devastating. There's been no interest income on savings for years. This is hurting retirees who have to draw down their capitals as they have no interest income on their savings. The huge increase in the quantity of dollars that resulted from quantitative easing, which is still going on in various forms. To protect the dollar, Washington has to have the Japanese central bank do quantitative easing, the European central bank do quantitative easing, so that those currencies are also being created in vast quantities. That prevents the dollar from declining relative to the other large currencies. So the House of Cards is really operating on a worldwide basis. And then if you turn away from the financial economy to the real economy. You see there's very little of it left. So much of American manufacturing has been offshored, largely to China. So much of the professional tradable skills, such as software engineering, information technology, research, design, these have also been moved offshore so that college graduates can't find the middle-class jobs. The Federal Reserve reported recently that 50% of 25-year-old Americans are back at home living with their parents. So you've got half of the young generation unable to form households. So there can't be any real estate demand, any demand for home furnishings. The unemployment rate is rigged because they don't include in the rate that they report, the U3 rate, which is always a headline rate, now 5%, that contains not a single discouraged worker. And yet there are huge numbers of them. We have the facts that the labor force participation rate has been declining for years. That's not consistent with recovery. Anytime there's an economic recovery, the labor force participation rate rises as people enter the workforce seeking jobs. So it's a contradiction in terms to say you've got an economic recovery when the participation rate in the workforce is collapsing. Wherever you look, there's just rigged numbers, rigged financial system. The real economy has been given away to India, to China. The jobs that they say are created are part-time jobs that no one can sustain themselves with, low-paid domestic service part-time jobs. The situation is really horrific. You just think about the fact that in the last job report, it turned out that all of the increased employment, in fact, more than 100% of the increased employment went to in the age group of 55 and older, whereas the people in the prime working age group from 25 to 54, they actually lost 120,000 jobs. Now, the financial press never tells you anything. They just give you the raw number. Oh, we had so many new jobs. And so no one really gets the picture. You have to just look to the next line to see that what they report is good news is really horrific news, devastating news. Nothing but part-time jobs for retirees who have to take them because they've got no interest income on their savings to supplement their Social Security. So that's the situation here. It's a desperate situation. It's maintained by rigging. They rig the numbers. They rig the markets. And that sort of situation will collapse.
Dr. Roberts, you've certainly outlined very eloquently here a disturbing scenario facing the domestic economy, and not to mention the at least 100 million folks who are working age and maybe in the prime of life. Some of these statistics you've brought to the fore here might be difficult for the typical listener to wrap their minds around. Maybe, I mean, you're obviously a seasoned economist with a remarkable tenure. And I'd like to illustrate using another economist we've had on the show, John Williams from Shadow Stats, illustrating what you've laid out here visually. He has shown that if you deflate the GDP numbers, the official numbers given to us by our officials, policymakers, by the actual inflation rate, then what you've said is correct. We've been in a mild, at least, recession since the year 2000, deflating the official numbers by the actual price most of us here have to pay when we go to the pumps and we're at the grocery store, when we're filling our prescriptions at the pharmacy, paying student loans. Those figures, due to the insidious inflation and profligate money printing by our central bankers around the world, not just here domestically, has deflated away the income of most Americans. And my guess is then that we're living on borrowed time. Is that a fair assessment?
We're living on the accumulations from the past, the savings of the older people. When children have to go back to live with their parents, or in many cases, their grandparents. And in fact, there are cases where children and grandchildren have to go back to the grandparents. You're living on the savings.
Calling it the lost generation in Japan and Europe now.
Yes, it's a serious situation. As I said, it's global. Remains to see, to be seen, how it collapses and falls apart. We got into this, I think, because it began with Wall Street pushing American manufacturing firms to increase profits by moving their manufacturing operations offshore, because it dropped the labor costs dramatically and various kinds of compliance costs with environmental and other regulations. And so the profits went way up, and this made Wall Street happy, made shareholders happy. And because the executive's pay is largely bonus-driven, then the increase in profits from moving offshore produced the extraordinary rise in executive pay. You know, it used to be an executive would make some 30 or 40 times what the workmen in the workforce made, and now they make 300 to 400 times. So this was the beginning. You forced the manufacturing jobs offshore. Wall Street would tell the firms, if you don't move offshore, we'll finance takeover of your company and move it offshore. And the big box stores like Walmart would tell their suppliers, meet the Chinese price. And the only way they could do that would be to offshore their operations. And then this spread into tradable professional skills like engineering that can be done anywhere and sent in on the high-speed internet. So this basically destroyed the middle-class jobs that had provided ladders of upward mobility for both industrial workers, manufacturing workers, and for college graduates. So when you dismantle these ladders of upward mobility, the middle class stops growing and begins shrinking. And the result of increasing the profits by offshoring the high productivity, high value added jobs meant that the income and wealth distribution in the United States worsened and is now worse than about half of the third world countries. So basically destroys a consumer economy. If consumer incomes can't grow because there's no good jobs, there's only part-time Walmart-type jobs, then the consumer demand that drives the economy is simply not there. So when this first showed up, Alan Greenspan was the Federal Reserve Chairman, and he said, oh, well, what we'll do, we will substitute an increase in consumer indebtedness to make up for the loss of growth in consumer income. So we had the credit expansion, the real estate boom, where people were refinancing their homes, taking out equity created by Greenspan's low interest rates, and spending the equity. And so we kept the economy going a few more years by indebting the consumer and having it a debt-based consumer demand. Well, that ran out of steam. You can't take on debt indefinitely, especially when your income's not growing. So when that ran out, we've been in a situation that John Williams describes. There's really been no recovery from the downturn in December of 2007. They disguise this fact, exactly as you reported, as John says. They don't measure inflation accurately. What they do, they have two tricks they use. One is, if the price of an item in the basket of goods that they use to measure the consumer price index, if the price of one of those items goes up, they just throw it out and stick in something cheaper. So the consumer price index no longer measures a constant standard of living. It's measuring a falling standard of living. And the other trick is, if a price of something goes up, they say, oh, it's not a price increase, it's a quality improvement. Now, there is something to that. So, you know, there are price increases that result because of quality improvements. But they use this to the extreme. And also, this sort of approach ignores the fact that it's still costing the consumer more, but his income's not rising. So whatever they want to call it, they are underestimating the erosion of real purchasing power. And that's why I think we see what we seem to be seeing at the moment, that retail, the large department stores like Nordstrom's have already started their sales. Everybody has got sales, massive sales. The hotels in New York now offering free breakfast. Wherever you look, you see that retail, anything dependent on consumer expenditures, is under tremendous pressure. So we may well find that John Williams' predictions will come true. He said we had a big downturn. We've been doing bottom bouncing, and we're about to turn down again. So if we get another downturn on top of the one we never recovered from, what policy do the policymakers have? They haven't got any. They've already had massive deficits, massive money creation. It's done nothing to bring back the real economy. It's only sustained the balance sheets of four or five megabanks. So there's no policy that they can use at this point. So I think the country does face massive economic risk. And at some point, this will affect the dollar. And when it affects the dollar is when the whole thing falls apart. You see, the Federal Reserve can print all the money it wants to buy all the bonds, keep the interest rates zero or even negative. As the bond market is about three times larger, I think, than the equity market or stock market, they can print all the money they want to buy stocks or to buy S&P futures. So anytime the stock market starts collapsing, they can step in and buy S&P futures and arrest the collapse. But they can't print foreign currencies to buy the dollar. So the minute they run out of swap agreements with the European Central Bank, the Japanese Central Bank, the other two large currencies, how can they support the dollar if a run starts on the dollar? So I think that's the main point of vulnerability. Kept it going longer than I expected, longer than John Williams expected. And I think they've been able to keep it going. It's just a question of when.
What you brought up here, I think, your breadth of analysis in this area is important for our listeners to digest. This concept that the powers that be, our policymakers, may be in collusion with some of the top money center investment banks, swaps and other agreements, and highly leveraged instruments such as CDSs and other instruments of very heavy leverage of 50 to 1 or more, could be holding up the markets. And then there's another component here where the Federal Reserve is the buyer of last resort for treasuries. We're hearing that China, Russia, many of the BRICS nations are divesting their huge portfolios of what was the de facto reserve debt for, let's say, 40 years. And this may no longer be the case. Do you care to give us an idea of what would happen if rates, as seen by the 2-year Treasury yield, were to suddenly spike up in the U.S. with our Federal Reserve as the buyer of last resort for our debt?
Federal Reserve can print all the money it wants or needs. And so the Federal Reserve can buy all the bonds that the Japanese and or the Chinese, the BRICS, sell. The rest of the world might pull out of treasuries, doesn't stop the Fed from buying them and maintaining the zero interest rates or the negative interest rates. Where the problem for the Fed would come would be when the Chinese and the BRICS and the rest cash in their bonds. Of course, they're paid in dollars. What do they do with the dollars? If they dump the dollars into the foreign exchange market, how can the Fed maintain the dollar's value? They can't, because they can't print foreign currencies to use to purchase the dollars. So the vulnerability in the system is what happens if the holders of U.S. treasuries, when they cash the bond, when they sell the bonds and they're paid in dollars, what do they do with the dollars? They buy up gold and silver. That would drive up the price, but the Fed knows how to stop that, because the price of the physical metal is actually set in the futures market, where mainly paper contracts are traded. The COMEX, the futures market in gold and silver, hardly any of it settles by people taking delivery in gold. The contracts settle on a cash basis. So the government or the Fed can have the bullion banks print up endless numbers of uncovered short contracts. And that's a way then of increasing the supply of paper gold in the market where the price is determined. And then they dump these contracts into the market and drive down the price. So we have today the very curious situation where the rest of the world is accumulating gold and silver hand over fist. In fact, there have been such shortages that both the U.S. Mint and the Canadian Mint have several times had to either ration or suspend delivery of the silver 1 ounce coins. We see the various gold trusts being looted of their holdings, and the speculation by the bullion banks, and the speculation is that is in order to have deliveries to meet Chinese and Indian demand. If they sell all their treasuries, the BRICS, the Chinese, does all the money go into gold and silver? If it does, the price would obviously explode. It would be no longer something that the Federal Reserve's agents, the bullion banks, could control the futures market. What would they do with these dollars? Would they use them to buy up other resources? Would they buy up all the land they can find, wherever, all over the world, South America, Africa, wherever, raw materials? What would they do with all of this? You know, the Chinese dollar holdings are vast. And so the problem that the world has in trying to get out of the dollars is what to do with them, where to put them, where are they to go. It's no good putting them into more dollar-denominated assets if you don't want to hold dollar-denominated treasury bonds. Why do you want to hold dollar-denominated stocks? So there is some sort of a limit on countries' ability to get out of the dollar simply because there's so many of them and they've been holding them for so long. How do you get rid of them? How do you get out of them? Where can you go? This, I think, is one of the things that protects the ability of the Federal Reserve to rig the system in behalf of the big banks, because a flight from the dollar isn't all that easy. It can happen on the margin and in a piecemeal basis, but how can it happen all at once? If it could happen all at once, then China could bring down the United States. It wouldn't need a war. It could just dump all of its dollar holdings into the foreign exchange market. So I think that this rigged system can last longer. And it's not speculation that that the authorities are in cahoots with the big banks. Look, who are the secretaries of the U.S. Treasury? They come from the big banks. What secretaries have we had in recent years that don't come from the... Well, Geithner comes from the New York Fed. The trustees of the New York Fed are the big New York banks. So the New York banks run the New York Fed. Everybody who comes in to the office of the Secretary of Treasury, they come from Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase or Citibank. Who are the heads of the financial regulatory agencies? Again, it's the bank executives. So the entire economic policy of the United States is controlled by the big New York banks. Just three or four banks, and they make the decisions. They control. They decide who's the Secretary of the Treasury, who's the Fed chairman. They preside over the New York Fed, which is the main operating arm of the Federal Reserve. So it is a situation that is run in the benefit of the banks. You see that what the deregulation, the financial deregulation, allowed such massive financial concentration that they now say that there's this four or five of these banks are just too big to fail because they involve too much of finance. Whether they're too big to fail or not, they control the levers of power. And so you have a situation where the economy is run for them, not for the people. This is why there's no recovery. This is why the savings of the system are drawn down. There's zero interest rates. This thing, what does it mean for retirees not to have any interest income for years? For years. What does it mean for insurance companies? What does it mean for pensions? Pension managers. There's no interest income. How do they provide for their liabilities? You know, you if you are running a pension fund, you owe people retirement. How do you get it? You have to take higher and higher risk. What do the insurance companies do? Where is a safe point in their portfolio if you've got zero real interest rates? What do they have to do? They have to buy Greek bonds, speculative stocks. What do they, you know, this? So it endangers all the rest of the financial system. I mean, the insurance companies have to be in trouble. The pension funds have to be. Because there's no way to have any sort of balance. You can't, unless you take large risk, you can't get any return at all. And those risks can wipe out your capital or a large percentage of it. So it's really produced by a handful of people for the benefit of a handful of people. This was not possible in the years that I was in the Treasury. This is a new development. It's outside all experience. It's a situation in which the entire economy is sacrificed for half a dozen people.
Essentially, Wall Street has infiltrated our U.S. Treasury. And of course, as Meyer Rothschild pointed out, I care not who's running the country. Those who own the reins of the money supply really make the laws. Overthrow of capitalism.
Well, it's what Michael Hudson calls the financialization of the economy, where this industrial capitalism no longer exists. You have a handful of big banks looting the economy by taking every bit of surplus and capitalizing it into debt instruments that brings interest into the banks. So that's what Michael Hudson calls financialization.
And as we wrap up the discussion, this earlier scenario that you outlined regarding what is an end game, I think one could call, for our currency, the de facto reserve currency globally, could this play out in a much more abrupt manner than some are expecting? In other words, currently the dollar is strong because Europe and Japan are obviously holding rates as low as possible to under the weaker currencies on a bad block. From the scenario you've laid out, the middle class is just in such bad shape that not only can they not maintain their current status quo, but there's really virtually no way to prepare for the train wreck that's headed this way.
That's about it, yeah. You see, the European Central Bank is engaged in quantitative easing. They're producing 60 billion new euros every month. The Japanese quantitative easing is even higher than it was under Bernanke. So those two currencies are growing at very high rates, and that then offsets the fact that the U.S. currency grew at such high rates during Bernanke and the QE, such that the supply of dollars in the world tripled, quadrupled in a few years. Well, normally that would drive the price of the dollar down, the price of the euro and the yen up. To prevent that from happening, Washington has had the European and Japanese central banks furiously, so that the supplies of their currencies have kept up with the supplies of ours, so there's no real change in the status of the dollar relative to other currencies. So, and as most of this money seems to stay inside the banking system and doesn't find its way into the economy itself, you don't experience the high rates of inflation. But you do stabilize the dollar by destabilizing the other currencies as well. So how long can that go on? Nobody really knows. This is kind of like a new thing. See, what we're going through is new. It's not a repeat of what's happened before. This is a new thing, and we don't know what the end game will be. We don't know, as I said earlier, what the corrective policy could be. If we end up with another downturn on top of the previous one, you see, John Williams says the current rate of unemployment, if you count the discouraged workers, you count all the workers who have removed themselves from the workforce because they simply can't find a job, 23%. So if we're at 23% now and we go down further and we're at 33%, 43%, what do the authorities do? What's the solution? Easy interest rates when they're already negative? More government deficits when we've had massive deficits this whole period? What is the remedy? There doesn't seem to be one. People say, well, the only thing you could do, you just have to put everybody in the country on the payroll of the federal government, send them a check. And then they would use the money to buy things. Well, that possibly could unleash the high inflation. But it would not really do much for the economy because the economy has been moved offshore. It might put Chinese back to work and Indians back to work. The Americans could go to work as retail clerks or Walmart in marketing things that are made elsewhere. But this is not an economy. This is a third world economy. You know, in 2004, I predicted in a nationally televised conference that in 20 years, the United States would be a third world country. So let's see, that was, what, 11 years ago. And we're a lot closer to it already than I thought we would be. The United States has many aspects already of a third world country. The collapsing infrastructure. You can find a large number of third world characteristics that have already appeared in the United States. And it's, you know, it's sort of covered up by the fact that there's still some surpluses in the system from slavers in the past. The capital is being drawn down. But as it's drawn down, the ability of kids to move back in with their parents declines. Because parents may not even have a house, much less the ability to feed them. So all of this can be a slow process, or something can happen that brings it on quickly. It probably would be a favor if something happened that brought it on quickly, because you might have more chance to do something about it. But if it's a slow, drawn-out process through the generations, it's something people just get accustomed to, and they don't really realize that it could be any different, or that who's responsible. Or,
well, it really sounds like an indirect socialism. And what you've laid out, we're already seeing signs across the board. You talk about eventually either the system implodes or everybody's on the dole. Right now, there's 100 million who receive some sort of federal assistance, whether it be payment or other, each month. That's 100 million. That's roughly one out of three in the United States. Under the scenario you've laid out, we should expect 150, maybe 200 million, maybe eventually everyone.
That's already implied in the robot technology, isn't it? I mean, the patents on robots are held by a handful of people. So the entire GDP of the country, once all these robots are in place, would be going to a handful of people. No one else would have a dime. And so it would have to all be nationalized.
Did you see the article that originated from the UK in the past 2 weeks indicating that half of jobs would disappear at least over the next, I think they said, 10 to 20 years due to robotics and advancements in automation?
Yes, I'm very much aware of that, and even more. The implication of the technology is that capitalism could not possibly exist. The handful of people controlling the patents would have to be able to exterminate billions of people, which they do. And so it would have to be socialized. It would simply be the robots would do the work, and and the profits from this would be distributed among the population, and there would be no longer tiny property-holding class reaping all of the rewards from the robots. So I think that if societies permit these types of technology to displace people, they will also have to displace capitalism and private ownership, because the technology is not consistent with private ownership. The consequences of the technology are so drastic and dramatic in a private ownership context that private ownership would simply have to cease to exist. And it would be a good thing if you're going to have the robotics. There's no other way societies could function. You can't possibly have a society in which a handful of people have all the income from robotics and the rest of the country has got nothing.
How do our listeners prepare?
Look, all I can do is show you what the problems are, how we got into them, and it's not clear how you get out of them. Collapse, some kind of collapse, and what happens then, who knows? Or some massive war. If you simply pay attention, you can see the neoconservatives are driving for war with Russia and China. That would be Armageddon, wouldn't it? I mean, the war with Russia and China would be nuclear, be the end of the world. So maybe that's what will happen. If you look at statements coming out of Washington as we talk, statements in the American media as we talk, war.
Well, we received a warning about that war from some of the great thinkers of the past. Let's just hope that doesn't come to pass, but I'm afraid reading between the lines, I see similar signs. You've brought up so many important topics, and I think that you've covered the bases here for everyone. Oh, and is there any contact information you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, I have a website if they want to, the courage and the stomach to follow what's really going on. They can turn to my website, which is simply my name, paulcraigroberts.org, O-R-G. If this is too much for them and too disturbing, which it is for a lot of people, they don't need to go to the site. So all I can do is try to tell people what's happening, and it'll be up to large numbers of people as to what's done. But it would be a serious mistake to expect the government to care or to take a lead. The government is a captured, controlled operation run by a handful of special interests. Benefit of the special interest. Appreciate your interest in my views.
Thank you, sir. We'll look forward to having you back. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome CEO, President, and Director of Silvercrest Metals, Eric Fier, on his debut appearance at GoldSeek.com Radio. With nearly three decades of experience in the mining sector, certified geologist, his latest endeavor, Silvercrest Metals, is a spinoff of Silvercrest Mines, a favorite of GoldSeek, and our top analysts at Gold Forecaster. Welcome to the show, President Fier.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Thanks for joining us. And, you know, as we were talking before the show here, you've worn virtually every cap, as it were. Folks that come to mind who also led their companies to great success, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and some of these other folks who started off at the very bottom. And give us an idea of how your experience could bring similar synergies for your shareholders.
Well, yeah, I think I do hold a lot of hats here, taking things from discovery to studies to financing to construction to production. So I've been through all of those things many times in my career, and I could only hope to aspire to take our shareholders to the same price as Apple or Microsoft.
Before we jump into the latest news on your key exploration projects, please outline the impressive management team that you've assembled, including industry favorite Scott Drever.
Yeah, well, the same team at Silvercrest Metals is the same that was at Silvercrest Mines. Why fix something if it isn't broken? So we've just moved over pretty much everybody onto the seats here. We did a few shuffling of desks around in the office. But lots of success on the Silvercrest Mines. We look forward to lots of success under Silvercrest Metals.
Turning to your key exploration projects in the Durango region, of course, that's home to the Guadalupe property. The initial test results are impressive. They indicate solid gold and silver deposits. I wonder if you'd tell more about this interesting venture.
Yeah, the Guadalupe property was a First Majestic property, so that was part of the spinoff with the merger of First Majestic and Silvercrest Mines. And along with that property came a pretty good database of information. It is an exploration property. It currently surrounds the Gavilanes discovery that Santa Cruz Silver made a couple of years ago, and the ore body appears to run onto the property. The mineralization onto the property. So we look forward to following up on that. However, that's not our primary focus right now. We have two other properties in Sonora, the same location as the Santa Elena mine where Silvercrest Mines had all of its success. So those two properties were also carved out of Silvercrest Mines as part of that spinoff. The two properties are Las Chispas and Wasabas. And Las Chispas itself, I believe, next year will be the flagship for the company. It is in a silver, historic silver district with a lot of information, a lot of underground workings, up to 5 kilometers of underground workings. Half of that's exposed. You can go underground currently and face up in excellent mineralization. So we look at doing a lot more exploration on that property next year. It is located about 25 kilometers north of the Santa Elena mine, so there is synergies between Las Chispas and Santa Elena as a potential mill feed in the future, testing that scenario and working with First Majestic on that since they've acquired that property. And Wasabas is about 100 kilometers to the east of Las Chispas and Santa Elena, and we'll be doing some drilling between December and the first part of next year to start testing that. Our philosophy is to drill to kill or keep. I don't want to waste shareholders' time or money, so we want to get in, take a look at these things, be efficient, be systematic, be cautious with the money that we have in the bank, and have a discovery or get away, get out of it, and get rid of the distraction. This is the same philosophy we had in Silvercrest Mines, along with its success.
Sounds like that's a strategic edge that you have right there, your cash reserves. The careful management of those resources will be key to your success. Do you care to highlight any specific management decisions that you've made to overcome any hurdles and or any anticipated challenges you see on the horizon?
Well, in this market, as you know, I think we're muddling around here near the bottom. I think we'll be here for another 12 to 18 months. I'm looking for a rise in the tide sometime during 2017. Been through these cycles. This is my fourth one. I've seen them rise and fall and been able to survive all the cycles along with the management team here and still have success. So one example is the financing of the Santa Elena mine for Silvercrest Mines. We did that at the bottom of the market in May of 2009. So if you can start financing these things in the bottom of the market, you know you got a very strategic business model. Our business model that we apply is the phased approach. I think we're pioneers in this. A lot of companies are starting to follow this formula in this type of a market. The phased approach is to start out small, invest as little capital as possible, and grow through cash flow from that growth.
President Fear, I appreciate your candor. I share your sentiments, at least another tough 12 to 18 months. As the Federal Reserve and their colleagues continue to raise rates, I think we're going to see some challenging times for the underlying metals, but that should set the floor for the next impressive bull market. President Fear, as the discussion winds down, do you have any comments that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
Yeah, just keep in mind that Silvercrest Metals is just a reset or a redial to Silvercrest Mines. So if you look at the history of Silvercrest Mines, so we made our discovery at Santa Elena 2006 and 2007. I believe that's where we're at today with Silvercrest Metals. And the share price went from about 30 cents to a peak of $3 over the course of the next 8 years of that company. So I look at doing a similar philosophy and path for Silvercrest Metals. I think we got a great leg up right now. By the end of the year, we'll have about $7.5 million in the bank. which gives us a definite strategic advantage in order to do what we want in 2016 and beyond.
Well, to find out more about Silvercrest Metals, listeners are encouraged to direct their web browsers to SilvercrestMetals, all one word, .com, SilvercrestMetals.com. In addition, Yahoo Finance now has regular updates on the Silvercrest Metals shares. You can simply type in the ticker symbol SIL.V, or you can also punch in Silvercrest Metals, two words there, Silvercrest and then Metals, into their ticker search, and you'll find out all the latest information at Yahoo Finance. President Fier, we want to thank you for scheduling time today to highlight this exciting opportunity for investors at Silvercrest Metals.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There's been a lot of discussion, observation, and examples in recent months regarding the evolution and development of a cashless society. Currency withdrawal limitations at banks, not only in the U.S., but most other countries, is a primary focus. Some banks have prohibited cash and coins, with the exception of collectibles, from being held in safety deposit boxes. Borrowers have been restricted from using cash to make payments on mortgages, credit cards, equity lines, and auto loans. Much debate and speculation has ensued regarding how long it will take us to become a truly cashless society. This week I observed a simple, yet telling, real-world example of why I contend, for the most part, we are already there. I had pulled into a McDonald's drive-thru to order breakfast, and before I was welcomed or even asked to place my order, the young lady on the intercom informed me all their credit card terminals were down, and the only way I could pay for my order was with cash, both at the drive-thru and in the restaurant. She sounded quite anxious and defensive about the situation, as if she had received a lot of blowback on the matter. I told her that was fine as I pulled a $20 bill out of my pocket. When I circled around to the window to pay, the manager was standing next to the cashier and told me they had no idea when or if the credit card terminals would be repaired that day. I got my breakfast and pulled around so I could watch how the growing line of drive-through customers were going to respond to the fact that their plastic form of payment was no good at that moment in time at McDonald's. It was not a pretty picture. While I ate my breakfast, I would estimate 2 out of 3 customers drove out of the drive-through line and sped out of the parking lot. Clearly agitated and angry, they now had to rely on cash, and in most cases probably just a few dollars, to obtain their breakfast. But clearly, they did not have any paper notes in their pocket, and were relying strictly on credit or debit cards. The war on cash has already scored massive inroads. This small anecdotal example tells me we are already on the edge of the abyss, leading to a near cashless society where most people already rely on plastic and are panicked, angry, and caught short when the system fails and they don't have any paper currency to rely on. Never mind anything tangible like physical gold or silver for a real crisis. When credit seizes up for a fast food breakfast and the response is anger, frustration, and speeding through a restaurant parking lot, it tells me people's fuses are very short. At least in this case, they could literally drive next door to the Burger King or other restaurants where they could use their plastic. But what happens in a crisis or reset scenario where all the restaurants, all the grocery stores, banks, and other conveniences we have come to rely upon in our, quote, modern society, freeze up at the same time? Or a bank or shopping holiday is declared for a period of time, and there's no credit and no cash to rely upon? To what level will people's panic, anger, and fear rise to? It's a valid question, and it's one everyone should anticipate, answer, and prepare for right now while they can. Because if you're banking on someone to step in during that kind of a crisis and do it for you, don't be surprised if they do it to you. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers or entertainment for their companies or professional organizations, especially during this holiday season, please visit my companion website at robertian.com, where I have a new video posted with condensed highlights from my stage hypnosis show. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.